Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Park City Manager Matt Dias. He's got details about tomorrow's special council meeting. It is the final meeting until September 17th. And Park City Sunrise Rotary Club member Cheryl Bettler will be on the phone along with the executive director of the Bicycle Collective, Donna McAleer, telling us about the bicycle donation drive. Finally, the executive director of the Christian Center of Park City, Rob Harder, with an update on some of the services that the organization continues to offer. This is KPCW. Taking a look at some local news now. Early in July, Governor Gary Herbert issued a mandatory mask mandate for students, teachers, and staff as part of the return to school COVID-19 protocol. School districts were required to submit a school opening plan to the state by August 1st. As the back-to-school date draws closer, concerns persist about the risk-benefit of opening schools in the middle of a pandemic. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more.
The Utah Education Association, the state's largest teachers union, recently issued a statement questioning the safety of opening schools to in-person learning, specifically in areas around the state that are experiencing spikes in coronavirus cases. UEA President Heidi Matthews, representing the union members, says they want the governor to order a delay in school openings in those highly impacted areas. She says a COVID-19 risk assessment project from Georgia Tech outlines which Utah counties can safely open schools now. Summit County is identified at an 86% risk level, and Wasatch County is 79%. Matthews says educators are concerned the district plans use no standardized scientific method for deciding if in-person school is safe for students and teachers.
It is simply a completion of a plan from a local district that is submitted to the State Board of Education just for assurances only, but no approval process. And we believe that there should be that approval process that comes with some compliance assurances and a process to raise concerns without fear of reprisal. And then finally, teachers need and deserve the same rights as any other employee about safe working conditions, clarity of workload, what's covered leave, when exposed to an illness, et cetera.
Utah State Superintendent Sidney Dixon says a manual has been developed to help parents, students, teachers, and staff with expectations for a safe return to school. The manual can be found on coronavirus.utah.gov and on the State Board of Education website. She says people should read the entire manual as a helpful resource.
We are so appreciative of the state and local health departments who have been working throughout the summer and even into spring to meet with superintendents and charter directors to help them understand the ramifications on schools of some of these health conditions. The manual that Dr. Dunn described outlines many of the questions that we've been asked. And as stated, those are situations around quarantine, testing, safe conditions for teachers, what to do around activities and athletics, what a cluster looks like.
Matthews says the manual lacks mandated protocols for what schools should do when cases are identified.
It does not indicate any mandates or absolutes. There's a lot of recommendations. There's a lot of shoulds. But in terms of mandates or compliance expectations, those are really lacking. And finally, while it does address some educator rights, it simply doesn't go far enough because the educator rights it refers to have to do with things like privacy and that kind of thing. And it's really kind of conflicting. You know, this is what you should do when you are exposed to the virus.
Matthews is concerned about the modified quarantine recommendation, which she says doesn't go far enough to keep teachers and students who have been exposed to the virus from spreading it to others.
And teachers, you should quarantine. But, you know, if there's not a sub available for a continuation of quality learning for the kids, then you need to go back to school. And that is really concerning. We were lacking substitutes before the pandemic. And our sub pool consists largely of retired educators who are older.
The UEA is asking the governor to delay school openings and hold online classes in those counties identified with high case counts. She says the rush to open by the first day of school is an unacceptable risk for students and teachers. Park City School District Superintendent Jill Gilday, in an email, states reopening schedules and dates will depend on the trajectory of the COVID-19 virus. The current case counts in Summit County point to reopening as planned. Remote classes will be offered for those students who elect to not return in person. Gilday says Park City's small class sizes will make monitoring the illness and tracking cases easier. She said just one part-time teacher has announced they will not be returning this fall due to concerns about the virus. KPCW has reached out to Wasatch School District for comment, but has received no response. I'm Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
Well, the Park City Council is meeting just once this month, and on a Tuesday instead of a Thursday, on the phone with a preview of tomorrow's meeting, I have Park City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Leslie.
So how come only one meeting and not meeting until September 17th?
Well, we had planned several weeks in August this year to be able to sort of kind of clean the house and have staff step back and get organized and have a few weeks where we weren't, you know, rushing into council meetings with deliverables and deadlines. So I guess that was our first priority. And then it's also stacked up against our city tour every year. So this year, we're obviously not going on city tour, but we typically take at least 2 weeks off to allow for the city tour. And so when you stack those two together, it ended up being several weeks all at once.
So what about the coffee with councils and the Friday roundups? Are those also gone?
Well, we might continue some of those, endeavors. I think that will ultimately be up to our city council. But, in terms of staff, we're going to be doing a lot of planning for next year. We're probably going to be, identifying next steps on visioning. So we've got a lot of work to do, and having a few weeks off from council meeting will be very beneficial to us. But it's obviously perhaps a good time for some more community engagement, in that, most of us aren't traveling and most of us will be here. So there will be opportunities like that perhaps.
All right. And then why meeting on a Tuesday?
Well, the Tuesday was just, I can't even really remember the reason at the time. I think that, when we were planning to try to take several weeks off, it's just the way that the calendar lined up. But, this is something we had in the works, 6 or 8 months ago now.
Wow. All right, let's see. A work session is scheduled tomorrow for 5:10 with a discussion on encroachments in rights of way and private driveways on city property. Apparently, this is a problem. Back in December, council asked staff to complete an inventory of existing encroachments on city property, including public parks and open space. So what's the problem?
Well, it's really sort of been percolating lately. We're trying to balance the realities of, being a kind of a modern ski town with an old mining district and historic district that has all sorts of, I'll call them misaligned rights of way. And sometimes the trees and a little bit of open space in someone's backyard or between their homes in Old Town is actually old rights of way or old trails or roads that were used in the mining days. And so for years or decades, we've had encroachments into those sections of city property. And it's just become a problem where residents are either sometimes maybe fighting over that those encroachments, or people have encroached without permission. And city council and the planning commission suggested we take a step back and try to come up with a more sound, sort of transparent policy, create a policy position. And so, we're really just trying to balance kind of the private use of public property, where that's appropriate or where that's inappropriate.
So the staff report notes that heated driveway encroachment agreements account for the majority of these agreements. How do they encroach in particular?
Well, so typically the driveway will need to have utilities or other type of equipment. And, some of those over time have been allowed in our property, in the public property, whether that's a right-of-way that's built or a right-of-way that's unbuilt. That's just, the siding on a road or the space in between homes where they need to run utilities. And so, for a long period of time, we had a very forgiving process. And so I think over time, as growth and development has become more acute and the impacts with that, we're looking to harness that forgiveness and rein things in a little.
Okay. Should the city get paid for these encroachments?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I think that will be ultimately a council policy decision, but I think there are many other cities and towns like us around the country that have these historic districts and are trying to balance public versus private interest, and they have started charging. They've started different types of fee structures and actually started charging for these encroachments.
All right, let's see. The regular meeting starts at 6 o'clock. Council will get a second quarter report on the COVID-19 impacts on the city's vibrancy ordinance. This was a way to ensure that Main Street storefronts stayed open and not just rented out during the Sundance Film Festival. With so many businesses closed down, I'm guessing that we don't have much of a quarter report.
Well, yeah, I mean, I couldn't have said it better. We have a kind of an active monitoring program that we do. And obviously the second quarter is April through June for us. And so we suspended enforcement in our monitoring program just because there was, you know, forced business closures as a result of the coronavirus and our community's response to that. So we didn't think that was fair to be out there inspecting. So we're going to come in. We have a quick staff report, and we hope to come back actually in September and revisit with council how they want to handle that second quarter moving forward. You know, we've actually found some good progress with this new ordinance. We think we've diminished some of the kind of longer-term vacancies on Main Street, but obviously it wasn't fair to be enforcing this ordinance during the forced shutdowns.
All right. Let's see. The Rich Martinez sculpture, the old miner as we know him, this is of a miner drilling. Where is this planned to go?
My understanding is it's up near the Treasure Trailhead, and so the Public Art Advisory Board be allocating, I think it's approximately $5,000 for some site preparation for a big sort of metal statue of Rich Martinez. And you've alluded to it, a longtime family in Park City, not only in our mining culture, but was one of the families that helped springboard some of our skis culture in terms of fabricating lifts and chairs and poles and towers. And so the family has actually donated a significant amount of the cost, and the Public Art Advisory Board is suggesting that we come up with some of the site work.
Yeah. So it's not planned to be installed until next summer, since the piece hasn't even been commissioned yet. The Martinez family, though, are the ones paying for it?
Yeah, very, very generously, actually. I think it's a very, very large family, and in a collaborative way, they've come up with some funding. And I think we think it's a great idea in terms of our heritage and our legacy. And in particular, this one family that really kind of passed the torch from the mining generation to the ski era. So we think it's a nice accommodation and will look great.
All right. The city has offered rent abatement to those within the Arts and Culture District, as well as those tenants in the city library. This has totaled more than $125,000 since March. For those in the Arts and Culture District, they have to be out at the end of the month. So that's basically the end of that abatement. But what about the business at the library? And I'm guessing it's just the cooperative preschool there?
So there's a cooperative preschool, and obviously Lucky Ones is in the library. And I think they have a fairly small rent. But, you know, we're taking this through the end of September. This will be a council policy decision. But, you know, we're trying to put our money where our mouth is. We understand that small businesses and nonprofits are hurting. We have, you know, indicated to the community that we obviously be very supportive of any other landlords that are willing to be, you know, express some generosity for their tenants facing a hardship. And we're trying to walk the walk.
All right. Let's see. The sales tax update. The city collected some $391,000 in sales tax in May versus what was projected, only $76,000. So the expected tax shortfall overall now less than $3 million compared to the $3.6 million. Where is the biggest decline that we're seeing in sales taxes? Is it due to restaurants or lodging? Or, I mean, can you put your finger on it at this point?
Can't really put my finger on it. I mean, obviously the lodging numbers have dipped considerably. But remember, the month that we're talking about here is May, and you know, May was just more or less a complete shutdown. So, you know, that's not necessarily a great indicator. We were obviously very conservative in our estimates. We would rather obviously come in over the amount than under. But I hope the silver lining here is there is some recovery happening. We don't really understand the dynamics of it yet because this is such a small month overall. April and May are the two smallest months in terms of our kind of economic impact and economic vibrancy. So we're really, really looking forward to June, July, and August. We think those are going to be, you know, fairly solid indicators of things to come, of what type of economic activity can occur with social distancing, and how it can occur and how successful it will be. But the silver lining here is we were conservative in our estimates. And our hope is, you know, this may be the difference between us cutting some services later on in the year or having to make layoffs in an area where we can't afford those services anymore. So it's a little bit of a cautiously optimistic here, but I want to kind of minimize any expectations because these are two very, very small months. April and May are our smallest months.
Sure. So when does the next kind of analysis happen? I know that you kind of wanted to wait a few months just to see how things were trending.
No, great question. So our plan is to come in mid-September, and we'll have a robust budget update in mid-September. That will also have June sales tax numbers. So we'll be reporting in September. We're operating under a tentative budget for 60 to 90 days, and our hope is, you know, by then we have a little bit more certainty, a little bit of a better outlook. But, you know, things are going well, but we understand a lot of people are hurting out there and a lot of people are incurring hardships, and, you know, we're trying to support them where we can.
All right. Also, there's a nearly $5 million amendment to the Three Kings Water Treatment Plant. This is to do what?
Well, there's a bunch of kind of off-site or outside the treatment facilities improvements that need to be made in terms of dredging ponds, adding storm drains, utility service lines, sewer lines, water lines. And so this is kind of a significant amount of heavy infrastructure, capital-intensive construction that needs to happen off-site to service the site. So all of the utilities, we need to dredge several of the ponds, we need to add sewer lines and water lines, and this is that whole tranche of work that needs to occur.
So this is all going to happen after resorts use the ponds for the snowmaking after January 15th. Will this impact the Nordic skiing there at all?
Well, our hope is it won't. We've been working, obviously, with our vendor, and we're very sensitive to the needs of the golf course and the cross-country skiing. And so we think we can accommodate everything as we've been doing this summer with the golf course. There may be some small impacts, but we intend for that concession to be open this year at the golf course for cross-country skiing. And, you know, there may be some noise and some other impacts, but we think that, you know, dredging ponds in February or March should not impact the trails in terms of, you know, we should be able to work around them.
All right. And then another addendum to the agreement for the Architects of the Arts and Culture District, this one for $633,000. We're up to more than $1.9 million for the architecture and engineering. It sounds like a lot of money. Is that normal?
Well, it does. I mean, I think we're still well within any sort of best practice in terms of architectural costs to the overall project. So this is a $633,000 addendum, and it's really to have the architects start addressing the interior of spaces, utility alignments, putting together our master plan development package, putting together a demolition schedule in terms of moving soils on-site or off-site. And so we still think we're well within any industry standard of architectural services, and, you know, typically that's around 8%, and we're feeling very comfortable with where we are.
All right. There was also action last week to approve there will be more, I should say, action tomorrow to approve some amendments to the car-free events. They will be extended through October 25th. And then at last meeting, we added three Saturdays. Saturday's car-free event evidently came as a surprise to a lot of people, including our local police department. Main Street closure was not promoted, apparently, and the city's digital signs coming into town. There was a police officer that a friend spoke to telling her that it was news to her it was happening, and apparently just a cluster of cars all backed up down Sweet Alley with nowhere to go and only one police officer there at the top of the street. So I guess what happened, or better yet, what didn't happen on Saturday?
Yeah, you know, I had heard a little. I hadn't heard it was quite that bad. I guess there was some confusion if it was this weekend or next weekend, and I think some of us, you know, just maybe lost sight of where the Arts Fest weekend was supposed to fall. But, you know, so this item, we're coming in and sort of just curing the existing permit that we have for car-free Sundays, as you mentioned, expanding it to Saturdays. We had a little, you know, confusion this weekend, but we don't anticipate, you know, any confusion going forward. We think they've been, you know, by and large successful, and that's why HPCA is asking us to extend them to October. But this item is actually just curing that permit through October, adding the Saturdays, and we'll make sure that all the necessary kind of infrastructure and support to support those is in place going forward.
All right, let's see. In new business, a public hearing on the proposed changes to the 2021 Sundance Film Festival Master Agreement. We're going to be shortening the festival from 10 to 7 days and pushing dates back January 28th to February 3rd. And this was being done just on Sundance's lead here?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think Sundance came out with this plan, almost over a month and a half ago now. So I don't think it's a big surprise to those that are following it, and certainly not our business and trade associations that are involved with the Chamber of Commerce or otherwise that have received updates. But, you know, just to be really succinct, it's shortening the number of days and aligning the dates of the festival. It's minimizing some use of city facilities. And then there's a provision for kind of making sure that 70% of the festival is taking place in Park City. And, you know, Sundance is coming in and just saying, we're facing a new reality. And I think we're very thankful and that they want to continue the festival this year, despite, you know, all of the challenges that are created for them. And you know, we have every intention of being supportive and seeing how we can assist. So they're coming in early, making sure they're giving that indication to council. And we're going to have to see where we land. And they're obviously facing a difficult, you know, situation with social distancing and how to have, you know, this festival in town and have it safely. And I think we're going to try to do everything we can to support them.
Yeah. So just using the library as opposed to the library and the Mark?
That's my understanding. Yeah, that's my understanding. And so, you know, that we have a contract with Sundance that we approve every year and supplemental plans about transportation and city facilities and all of the technical and operational aspects that go into it. And Sundance is coming in early and seeking to amend those to reflect kind of the new norm that we might face in February.
Yeah. Any idea what kind of losses the city's going to suffer as a result of all of this scaling back?
Well, we're not really sure. You know, as we were talking about before in terms of sales taxes and lodging taxes, you know, we're looking at those closely. This is obviously a huge week for all sorts of businesses in our town and all sorts of property owners and for the city. So we're looking at it closely. We're working with the chamber. We're working with Summit County and the resorts. And I think we're trying to get a clearer and better picture, but it's a little bit early to say.
All right. And it also notes that Sundance won't have to be paying for or provide additional transit services. So we're going to use just our regular bus schedule for those who do come.
Well, right now we're looking at whether that accommodation will be sufficient. And I think, you know, depending on the size of the festival, depending on the number of visitors, and depending on the type of festival, we may have an existing level of transit service that it can accommodate this scaled-down festival that's happening in multiple different cities, and a lot of it's happening virtually. And so we may have sufficient services already available, but we'll have to report back into council this fall with a full transportation plan. But we wanted to let council know early on that if we're not going to have the same level of visitation, it may not be required to have all the additional transit amenities that we would normally have.
Right. Anything else, Matt, you wanted to mention?
No, that's it. Thanks, Leslie. I appreciate it.
Thanks for your time. That's Park City Manager Matt Dias. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, the Park City Sunrise Rotary Club, in partnership with the Bicycle Collective, are planning a Bicycle Donation Day. On the phone with Sunrise Rotary, I have member Cheryl Butler. She's joined by the executive director of the Bicycle Collective, Donna McAleer. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Cheryl, let's start with you and just tell us a little bit about this kind of falls on what you had planned to be your annual tour to Sunrise and kind of have morphed into this.
That's correct. Every year, folks remember that we do this wonderful event in conjunction with the Summit County Fair. We have a bicycle parade that leads the County Fair parade on in August, and then it's followed up by the Tour to Sunrise, this wonderful family event over in Colville that goes up to the Echo Reservoir. And this year, unfortunately, like many of the events associated with the fair, it was canceled. And we're not going to stop. We want to do something for community service. And this proposal came up to work with the Bicycle Collective, and it just seemed to fit perfectly. So on the day we had scheduled for Tour to Sunrise, we're now doing a bicycle drive.
Okay, and I'll get to that in just a second. But the Tour to Sunrise has also been a fundraiser for you, so you're just going to forego that?
Well, generally, we do ask for funds to be contributed. You contribute a registration fee, but in general, we really don't make money. It's more of a community project that we do. It pays for itself. Let's put it that way.
Okay. And before we get to Donna to talk about the Bicycle Collective, this Bike Donation Day is happening this Saturday, August 9th, 9 to noon. And you've got, what, a number of local shops in Park Summit and Wasatch counties that you're hoping people drop bikes off at?
Yep. Yes, that's exactly right. We're really excited because this is an opportunity not just to partner with a nonprofit, the Bicycle Collective, but to highlight our wonderful Wasatch-backed bicycle shops. And they have been tremendous in working with us on this. We have over 10 shops signed up right now in both Park City as well as Midway Heber area that will all be opening their shops up on Saturday, August 8th from 9 to noon to collect bicycles.
All right. So, Donna, let's bring you into it. What is the Bicycle Collective?
Good morning, Leslie. Well, first off, the bicycle drive is Saturday, the 8th of August. So I don't want people to get confused with that, not Sunday the 9th, so Saturday the 8th. The Bicycle Collective is a group of nonprofit bike shops throughout the state of Utah. We have locations in Salt Lake, Ogden, Provo, and St. George. And we refurbish and upcycle donated bikes by the thousands each year, and we put them into the hands of people in need, those that are income eligible, newly resettled refugees and immigrants, individuals experiencing housing insecurity, recovering from substance abuse, and children, particularly with families that may not be able to afford a bicycle. So we give bikes a second life. We're like a value-added thrift store.
Yeah. So is this just a statewide nonprofit or is it worldwide? Because I did see something like this in Uganda.
Yeah, there's a lot of different collectives or collaboratives. We're all part of a network that collaborates, but we're all run individually with different business models. So not uncommon. The four shops that are part of this nonprofit are all in Utah.
All right. So tell us, I mean, what are you hoping for on Saturday morning then?
Well, we're hoping that anybody who's got a bicycle sitting in their garage or out in their lawn that hasn't been ridden, that's in need of a new home, that they donate it to the Rotary and the Bicycle Collective so that we can repair it or strip it for parts and then recycle what's not usable. Bikes last a really long time, and you know, the great thing is that bicycles are a great way to get exercise, to be socially distant, to enjoy adventure and exploration. And we don't want to see any bikes end up in landfills or garbage cans. So we make as best use as we can. Last year, we gave away more than 1,300 bikes to people around the state, and we recycled about 27 tons of metal and 6 tons of rubber.
Wow. So who does the repair work?
So we have professional mechanics in all our shops, as well as a group of highly trained core volunteers. So like many nonprofits that we are all familiar with, we are driven by volunteer investment and commitment to the organization. Given we used to be able to have volunteers, each shop has a couple different hours. Volunteers would come in groups and work in our shop on our benches and using our tools and repair bikes, teach each other about bike mechanics, build on each other's strengths. Since coronavirus hit in March, we've had to find a new model, and right now our volunteers are taking a lot of those bikes home, and they work on them at home. We give them parts and tools, and then they bring them back to the shop, and our professional mechanics check them. So like every other business, we've adapted as well.
Sure. So these 10 shops that are going to be collecting on Saturday, they're not necessarily doing the work. They're just going to be the collection spots?
Exactly. Cheryl Butler and Steve Canton of Sunrise Rotary have worked with all these shops. Our goal was to really make this a community effort to, again, people looking to maybe upgrade their bike or to maybe buy a new bike that they would consider contributing their old one, and we would drive some traffic to the new stores.
All right. So, Cheryl, then what's Rotary Club doing? It once they get all the bikes, you're going to haul them down to these to the places where they're going to get fixed?
Yeah, I think that Rotary's role in this was really to build on our network with the business community and to help the Bicycle Collective make those connections throughout the Wasatch Back, where maybe people aren't as familiar with their efforts. And then we'll have Rotarians stationed at each of these different bike shops on Saturday to do the actual collection so that the bike staff doesn't need to be doing that. And then we will help load them all up and take them where they need to go.
Okay. And are they all going to Salt Lake then, Donna? Because you've got them Ogden, St.
No, we're going. The bikes will be collected and kind of divided between Salt Lake, Provo, and Ogden on this particular bike drive. And just last year alone, one of our volunteers, Rick Colton, who lives in Park City, he worked with the Park City School District to identify those students who didn't have a bicycle and would like a bicycle. And we bought about 40 or 50 bicycles up to the four elementary schools and Ecker and Treasure last year to provide bicycles to our students here in Summit County. So they are distributed out of four locations, but they really go everywhere in the state.
Okay. Again, this is happening Saturday, August 8th from 9 to noon for a bicycle drop-off. I mean, the Jans, Cole Sport, White Pine Touring, Storm Cycle, of course. Can you tell us the others that are also going to be accepting these or a place that people can go online to find out where to drop the bikes or bike parts?
Of course. So in addition to the ones that you mentioned in the Park City area, we have Pedego, Contender, and Bonhof on Main. And then in the Heber Midway area, we have Gravity Coalition, Midway Adventure Co., and Slim and Nobby's. And that list is actually growing each day as more bicycle shops want to get involved. And so if you want to see the latest list of drop-off locations and the specific addresses for your neighborhood, just visit the Sunrise Rotary website or our Facebook page.
Okay. Sounds like you got lots of places to drop off. Now we need the bikes.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And we'll also take bike parts and components as well, because we can use those as spare parts. And if people aren't using them again, we're happy to recycle them.
Okay. Hey, Donna, Cheryl, thanks for your time this morning.
Oh, thank you, Leslie.
Well, the Utah Department of Health report of a coronavirus death on Sunday brought the state's number of deaths for a 7-day period to the highest mark since the pandemic outbreak began in March. The Salt Lake Tribune reporting the latest fatality related to the coronavirus was one of 37 in the week. The second highest number of deaths occurred in the previous week when the deaths of 32 people were attributed to the virus. The state health department says 203 people are currently hospitalized with the coronavirus. Republican Utah Governor Gary Herbert says the state has no intention of delaying the November election following President Donald Trump's suggestion that increased mail-in voting due to the coronavirus pandemic would result in fraud. Herbert characterized postponing the election as foolish. Meanwhile, the state hit the grim milestone Thursday of 300 total deaths from the coronavirus, but the rate of new cases has begun to decline. The state epidemiologist says she is feeling cautiously optimistic about the state's lower case counts as schools eye reopening for the fall. She says school districts will decide their own reopening strategies with the help of local health departments. News time, 8:44. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, almost 5 months into the COVID-19 pandemic, and the community continues to turn to the Christian Center for food, help pay their bills, and keeping them in their homes. On the phone with an update, I have the director of the Christian Center, Rob Harder. Good morning, Rob.
Hey, good morning, Leslie.
So let's get a quick update on the numbers. In terms of the Basic Needs Assistance Program, how much have you guys been raised and given for this? Because it's also getting help from the Park City Community Foundation as well.
I do want to thank the Park City Community Foundation and all those who have contributed to that COVID-19 response. We just got another gift of $100,000. And so, yes, the good news is we have gotten another installment, which is going to help us with this third round. So we've, just the numbers real quick, we've given over $700,000 now since the beginning of this response. We're right in the middle of the third installment of rent assistance and other bills. It's primarily rent that we're helping with. We've helped well over 700 families now. And but here's the challenge. You probably have read about this. You've been hearing about it. In fact, I think you've talked about this on your show. You know, at the end of July, the CARES Act, where it prevented people from being evicted, that's now been lifted. And we've been working with landlords and apartment managers here locally to try to, you know, come up with a plan to prevent anyone from being evicted and making sure we know exactly who is at risk of eviction. And the good news is some landlords have done really good in terms of just responding and really wanting to help their tenants and help the clients and work with us and JFS and the city. Then there's been some other landlords that have not worked so well with us. In fact, we've gotten some reports from various tenants from their landlords that they will be moving forward with evictions if people cannot pay for their rent. So that's something we just need to be aware of, that that is a reality right now for August. And we're doing everything we can to just prevent that from happening.
Yeah. Can you put some numbers? I mean, any idea? I mean, are we talking about a handful of families that may have to leave, or are we talking about dozens?
That's a really good question. You know, we asked the landlords and apartment managers, could you give us like a list of people that are at risk of eviction? And I understand there's some privacy issues. They couldn't send us, you know, exact information, but we were just trying to get a number. So we weren't successful in getting even a number. But I would guess from the people that have responded, the landlords, that is, and the apartment managers and the people that we've helped, so the people that have received help from us, so far it's a small number. Now, that could grow as this continues through August, and if this, you know, economic slowdown continues even further, that could, you know, bleed into September. But I think right now it is a small number. And again, I just thank the community here. I think we've rallied as a community to provide, you know, rent assistance and other help with not just us, but, you know, again, JFS has jumped in, St. Mary's Church has jumped in. So there's been a lot of organizations jumping in to provide help. So I'm really hopeful and cross my fingers, Leslie, that this will be a small number that, and even with the group, small group of people that are at risk of eviction, we want to get to, that's the whole point, we're trying to get to them and to prevent them from being evicted, because then now we've got a way bigger issue of homelessness and where do they go and things like that. So that could be a much bigger issue.
Yeah, I was going to say, so I mean, other than helping to pay, what else is the Christian Center doing? Just trying to negotiate as well, or can you do anything else?
Yeah, I mean, we have. That's exactly right. We've said, hey, we're working with these clients. We've mentioned JFS again and St. Mary's are helping. What do you need to keep going? Because I know that landlords have to pay their bills and they have bills due. So we've been negotiating with them. We also have reached out to them and said, would you be willing to give like a 15% break or some kind of percentage break towards the rent of those who are struggling because of the COVID-19 response? And the good news is a lot of the landlords have. And in fact, some have given cash gifts to this whole basic needs assistance program. So they've actually financially given to the fund, which will then turn around and give right back to their clients. And so some have responded really well. So it has been a lot of negotiation and just advocating for these tenants at these various apartment complexes. The other thing we're helping with, of course, is other bills. Of course, the food pantry is always available, so we're always encouraging people. They can save a lot on their grocery bill every month by just coming to our food pantry and getting it for free. So we're trying to do that as well and provide some other scholarships along the way.
Okay. Food pantries, are they staying stocked, well stocked?
Yeah, you know, that's been really good. I feel like we're kind of stabilized in that sense. Yeah, we've got food enough, it seems like, both at Park City and Heber. So we've had plenty of food for people that have come through. Our numbers have even, you know, been very, like, almost normal, I would say, now. Now, granted, we've lost a lot of our J1s. You and I have talked about this before, and they've, you know, they've left. The ones who were here in the winter, they got stuck. Most of them were all finally able to go back home. And then there's normally a group of H2Bs and J1s that come during the summer. They did not come because of COVID, of course. So that's often a group of people that come to our food pantry that we did not see, and therefore our numbers, you know, this showed in our numbers, bottom line.
Okay. The Christian Center also offering some mental health counseling. What sort of needs are you seeing right now?
Yeah, that one, else to say, with all the other things going on, that has been probably the most intense. I would say it's the most urgent, Leslie. We have seen a lot of people that have just had extreme levels of anxiety. I think it's just a combination of stress, anxiety, depression, isolation, and it's turned into some real serious issues of people that were just, you know, thinking about suicide. And so the term is suicide ideation, and there's been a lot of that. And if you talk to our counselors, You know, every week there is a crisis or two that comes through the counseling center of just people that have, they're kind of at their wits' end and not sure what to do. Maybe have already had a plan to, you know, commit suicide or they're talking about it. And so that's been the most urgent and difficult situation that we've seen so far. But there's just the normal anxiety of just the unknown of COVID-19 and, you know, no end date to when this is going to be, quote, over. And I think that makes all of us just kind of anxious and worried. And then, of course, you throw in the economic uncertainty and the increase in COVID because the numbers have been going up. So all of that has just been a really bad mix, sadly. So our mental health counseling, yes, has seen a lot of calls and a lot of urgent situations.
Yeah. Any idea what the backlog is? I mean, if somebody were to call needing help, how long does it take to get in to see someone?
You know, it depends on the issue. But, yeah, the good news is we've been really we've added another staff person. We're in the actually process of hiring two more counselors. And so we're just adding to our staff because we need it. So it depends on the issue. If it's a crisis situation, you know, at the level of a suicide watch or a suicide issue, that gets immediately put to one of our counselors. Or we are working closely, of course, with Intermountain as well and other counseling services in the area. So we will work with them if there's a crisis. But otherwise, yeah, if you're it's just your normal, you know, monthly meeting or every other week, those are typically scheduled ahead of time. So we're pretty good there. I think I would say that if you're listening and you really need to talk to somebody, again, just communicate to our Heather is our primary counseling administrator. Just say, I really need to see someone now, or I can wait for a week, but I would like to get in within a week. So just let us know what your need is, and we'll just adjust accordingly. I will say this, Leslie, the one thing that's been interesting is we have noticed that during COVID, we've seen an 85% increase in people calling for counseling and needing financial help. In other words, they'd maybe gotten counseling before and they could afford it or their insurance covered it, but now their job has, you know, been taken away. They don't have the insurance anymore and they can't afford the counseling anymore. So we've seen this huge 85% increase in request for scholarship for our counseling. The good news is we have that right now. We have the bandwidth to be able to provide that. But that has been something that we've seen is that people cannot afford the counseling like they used to.
Yeah. And then the other programs that you've got, your thrift stores, your boutique, everything kind of moving forward normally, if we can call that?
That's right. Exactly. I mean, I think that's the one normal is that, yeah, it's going really well. I think people really enjoy shopping. They love getting good deals. And of course, people have been doing great spring cleaning, now summer cleaning, because we've had so many donations, which has been wonderful. So, yeah, so that's actually been really, it feels very normal. And our team's done a great job of, you know, just keeping masks on. And the public have been great. I think you've asked me before, how are people responding to wearing masks in the store? We really had very few issues. A little early on, but after the first week or so, everyone has complied. Everyone's, you know, very gracious and respectful. So, yeah, we've had no issues with our stores. And then the other thing that's kind of fun is a program that we've done every year now for the last, this is going on our ninth year, Back to School Basics. We're going to do it this year now. We're going to change it up because of COVID-19. But it's been kind of fun to see people in the community. They're so glad we're doing this program. And that will be spread out over 3 days as opposed to a one big one-day event at the outlets.
Yeah, and so this is, again, taking kids back to school for school clothing. One of the needs that we keep hearing about, though, maybe not so much clothing, is just internet service. Are you guys helping out with that at all?
You know, that's a great point. You know, we talked about this, you know, before we launched. You know, number one, we're trying to figure out, do we do this program again? And number two, is that the real need right now is clothing? And I think you're right. Internet service, more computers is probably the biggest need right now. The difficulty there's so many challenges of how do we provide that for people. And so the way we've communicated to our clients and those who typically signed up for this program is, okay, that may be really difficult to figure out how and how much we can provide and make sure you get the right internet. But what we could do is, let's, you know, most kids do need new school clothes. And so we can take care of that and cover that cost. And then the money you would have spent on clothes now can go towards, you know, your internet, increasing your internet or getting another computer or things like that. So that's what we've tried to do is try to shift around where they'd spend their money so that they could address some of these bigger issues. And then the other one is school supplies. That is still a big need, and that's one thing that we've always provided as the part of this program, too. So in addition to the clothes, we want to make sure all the kids have the supplies they need to start the school year. So that's actually, we're right in the middle of a school supply drive. So if you're listening and you want to buy some supplies or want to give towards that cause, that's another way you can give that's a big help to parents as well.
Okay. Hey, anything else, Rob, that you wanted to mention?
No, I just want to say thank you again for all the support. We just continue to feel the love from this community, you know, supporting us individually through encouragement, and then, of course, by giving to the Park City Community Foundation, who turns around and has given to us. Just say thank you for your wonderful support. We really appreciate it.
Okay, Rob, thanks for your time this morning.
Hey, thanks, Leslie.
Rob Harder is the executive director of the Christian Center of Park City. Well, the Summit County Council last week looked at two different transit topics. One involved a far-reaching long-range plan. Later on, as KPCW Rick Ruff reports, the council approved some decreases in their transit budget for the year.
The county council was introduced to the Wasatch County Transit Demand Study, organized by the Mountainlands Association of Governments. Councilmember Roger Armstrong said that MAG has done a good job of engaging the stakeholders involved.
We know that historically there has been some resistance in Wasatch County to having any kind of transit come here to Park City for a variety of reasons. And, you know, what I think is refreshing is that they engaged very deeply with seniors, with other groups, with elected officials in Wasatch County and Heber City and in Midway. And it seems that there's now pretty strong interest in developing some sort of a connection between Summit County and Wasatch County, which I think is remarkably positive. And I know that they also have concerns in Wasatch County with connections down into the Provo Valley because they have a lot of commuters there.
He said they have to look at the ramifications of a plan that could have impacts from the Utah Valley to Summit County.
You've got longer range transportation issues. How do you move people from Lehigh to Wasatch County to Summit County and back down? Or do we move people from Lehigh to Summit County? Is the demand there to do that? But then we've got the internal movement, you know, within the Snyderville Basin. At some point, I would guess, in eastern Summit County, probably in the Camas Valley at some point, if they continue the growth that I anticipate will happen over the next half decade or decade. So it's kind of the micro stuff that we have to focus on and the macro.
Later in their agenda, the council approved a cut of nearly 20% to the Snyderville Basin Transit District. Part of that, said Armstrong, was a revamp to the Brown route in the basin to make it more efficient and accessible. County Manager Tom Fisher summarized the changes for the council on Wednesday.
It is not going to be reduced service. It's going to be enhanced service. The riders will have the ability to use an app and request that the vehicle deviate from its route in order to pick them up. It is going to be a different vehicle. It won't be one of the large buses. It will be a smaller van that will be providing that service. It will follow the existing route and hours and days of service. It will remain fare-free. Everything else related to our COVID rules in regards to riding will be the same.
Armstrong said the budget decrease also reflects changes that Park City already made in the transit system.
When the pandemic hit, things started to slow substantially. Park City wisely decided that, you know, they needed to make adjustments to the schedules and the way the buses operated and how many buses we have operating to reflect that slowdown and the lack of use. Our ridership numbers are way down. So when they made those changes, it resulted in financial savings within the system itself. Some of those financial savings are allocated to Summit County's participation in that system. So we just have to adjust our budget to reflect the fact that we're not paying as much to make it true up.
County Council Member Roger Armstrong. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
67 degrees here in Old Town Park City, looking for another hot one. Mostly sunny skies with a high of 91. A red flag warning has been issued for today and tonight. It's 9 o'clock.